when Charles Dickens was appalled by what was going on in the workhouses in the 19th century, it appears that his main idea was not to start to have a great petition, to run a political campaign, or to campaign in the orthodox manner. What did he do? He wrote Oliver Twist. And the writings of men like Dickens, as people got into the narrative, got into the story, changed their opinions of what was going on so decisively that the foundations of our welfare state were laid at the end of the 19th century. Now, when the Bible wants to describe something as being bad, it doesn't always do it by telling us, don't do that. For example, polygamy. God made Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and he brought them together, male and female, and a man should leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife. One husband, one wife, one flesh. That's the plan. But men and women, from early days, decided to rebel against that plan. Now, God could have said again and again, don't be polygamous. Or he could give us Genesis 29 and 30. And a cursory reading of Genesis 29 and 30 does not tell you that polygamy makes people happy. You have Jacob there, seemingly kind of moving from one tent to another and being manipulated along the way. You have the wives at each other's throats. It's chaos and it's sadness. And the Bible, by giving us this story, one thing it does to us is it says to us, polygamy is bad. The consequences of sin, sin brings misery sooner or later. In the case of polygamy, sooner rather than later. But that is not the main point of Genesis 29 and 30, just to tell us polygamy is bad, though it does. Again, God has given us stories, and we read them, we read the narratives, and through the story, God is making his point. Now think about the original hearers of this story, this historical account. This is the first book of Moses called Genesis, and Moses was writing to the children of Israel, and the first time they'd be hearing this collected together would be in the desert. And this is the account of their tribal forebears born where? In the land or outside the land? Outside the land. And Moses is telling these people that this land you're in the, whether it's Egypt or in the desert, is not your home, but you can trust Yahweh, the covenant-keeping creator God, to lead you to his intended blessing against the odds and despite the failings of individuals. There's lots of failings of individuals in this narrative, but Moses is saying to these people, you're going to be in the land because God is going to bless despite a whole load of things happening. But this speaks on to us. It reminds us that this world is not our home, but we can trust Yahweh, the covenant-keeping creator God, to lead us to his intended blessing through Christ the curse reverser against the odds and despite the failings of individuals. That's the big message of Genesis. And this passage focuses on the despite. God blesses despite. So the first thing we can say this morning is thank God that he is a God of grace. Think about how many times, if you're a believer today, you have messed up. Thank God that he blesses despite the failings of individuals. Perhaps this morning that you're not yet a Christian and you're counting the cost of following the Lord Jesus Christ. And in your mind you're thinking, but I'm not sure I can keep it up. You're right. You can't keep it up. He needs to keep you up. And you need to know that God is a God of grace. The way in is the way on. The way in is a way of grace. You come with nothing and he saves you. And he preserves you and keeps you all the way through this life, despite your failings as you rely upon him. Because let's remember where Jacob's come from here. The whole context of this is, remember, Jacob's dream. Now remember, Jacob had that dream. Is it that Jacob promises to follow God and then God gives him a dream? Was that what happened in Genesis 28? It wasn't, was it? It's that God gave Jacob a dream and he said, I'm the God of Abraham and I'm the God of Isaac and I'm going to be your God. I promised to bless Abraham, I promised to bless Isaac, and now I'm promising to bless you. That promise had no conditions, no strings attached. God said, I promised, I am going to bless. I am the Lord, the God of your father and the God of Isaac. And then God said, your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth. I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. And at that point, Jacob said that he was going to follow him. And so what do we see in this chapter? So far, we've seen God said to Abraham that his descendants would be innumerable as the sand on the seashore in multitude, innumerable as the stars in the sky. And he had how many sons of God's promise? One. Same promise to Isaac. And he had how many sons? Two. It's going to be pretty slow multiplication at that place. So in this passage, God is keeping his promises to Abraham and Isaac, despite the failings of individuals. And we see rapid multiplication. God blesses despite. He is keeping his promises. Not endorsing the method. The method is clearly bad. Just like he didn't endorse Jacob deceiving his dad. The method was bad, but God blesses despite the failings of individuals. So, four things we'll see this morning. First, God blesses despite the godlier girl being unloved. God blesses despite the godlier girl being unloved. Now, you might say, well, where am I getting this godlier girl being unloved? Well, you say, I understand why she's unloved. It says, Genesis 29:31, that Leah was hated. This is not necessarily full-bore detesting her. As we saw, Jacob didn't seem to blame her. He blamed her dad, Laban, for what had happened. That word has some range of meaning. But Deuteronomy 21, verse 5, talks about a man with two wives, the one loved and the other unloved. And that's what God expects if people disobey him and have polygamous households. There'll be loved wives, unloved wives. And often the cause for polygamy is the first wife doesn't bear children, so the husband has a second wife to bear children. Which has a striking similarity to this passage, or obviously difference in order. So, you might say, okay, fine, she's unloved. But why is the suggestion here she's the godlier girl? Well, first of all, remember what Jacob was sent north to do. He was sent to find a wife, and he was supposed to find a wife who would be not one of the nations around who didn't love God. So when Eliezer of Damascus, most probably Abraham's servant in Genesis 24, went north, he went forth, do you remember, prayerfully. Did Jacob go forth prayerfully? No. Eliezer was led to Rebekah, who trusted God. Now let's see Leah and Rachel. What evidence do we have about their faith? Well, think about later on. When they flee away, what does Rachel take with her? The household idols. That's not very good news, is it? Look at this passage, and you might say, well, this passage just seems to be about all these children being born and their names. Yes, it is. Let's see how Leah names her children. Genesis 30:32. Leah conceived and bore a son. She called his name Reuben, for she said, because Yahweh, the covenant Lord, has looked upon my affliction. Verse 33. Because Yahweh has heard me, the covenant Lord. Verse 35. This time I will praise Yahweh, the covenant Lord. You then look at Rachel, and we only get reference to God in general. There's no kind of emphasis until we finally get into verse 32, when she says she bore a son, saying, God has taken away my reproach. So that's two pieces of evidence. We've got the household idols, we've got the emphasis of Leah and Yahweh, but we also ask this question. What is the center of the promise to Abraham? What is the most important thing? Is it the land? No. Is it the multiplication? No. What is the center of the promise? In your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And God says in Galatians that God is speaking singular seed, one seed. And he said that seed is Christ. Which wife had the messianic line? Leah, through Judah. So the line of the Messiah has already come by the time Leah ceased bearing. And that's interesting, that, isn't it? Look at Genesis 29, verse 35. She called his name Judah, then she ceased bearing. As if, well, that's done now. We've got the messianic line. There's Judah. The cursive verse is coming. Now, in our account, we're waiting for Rachel and all those things. But in terms of our salvation, that is assured by Genesis 29, verse 35. Judah's born. If no other children were born, Rachel will continue as barren, nothing else. Messiah's on his way. Now, God blesses despite the godlier girl being unloved. What other window do we have? Well, the window we have is really the first and only window into Jacob and Rachel's marriage. It's not the best eavesdropping, is it? Chapter 30 and verses 1 and 2. When Rachel saw she bore Jacob no children, she envied her sister, and she said to Jacob, "Give me children or I shall die." Now that's quite a strong reaction. We know the pain of barrenness, but let's just think about the difference between Rachel's reaction and Hannah's reaction. So Hannah was an loved wife. Do you remember? But her rival was provoking her. We've got no record here, have we, of Leah mocking, have we? Nothing about Leah mocking Rachel. Whereas Peninnah was provoking Hannah, but what did Hannah do? Hannah went and prayed. Rachel got angry with Jacob, and Jacob's response, one commentator said, was high on theology, low on compassion. Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? It's a kind of like, you know, when Naaman went to the king of Israel and he said, "Make me clean." And the king said, "Am I in the place of God? I can't do this." And Jacob said again, "This is not me. This is what God has decided." So God blesses despite the godlier girl being unloved. And it reminds us of the verse in Proverbs we saw last time. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. So godliness is to come first. But the big thrust of what's going on is that we can trust the covenant-keeping God to lead us onto his intended blessing despite the failings of individuals. Well, God blesses despite the godlier girl being unloved, and God blesses despite past sins being repeated. What happens next? Rachel says, "Here is my servant Bilhah, go into her, so that she may give birth on my behalf, that even I may have children through her." So Jacob said, "Rachel, have I not told you? My granddad Abraham went for this plan, and Sarah said, marry Hagar, and it was a complete disaster. It caused chaos, and we never want to go that way again." Did Jacob say that? No, Jacob did not say that. Now, you might say, well, at least Rachel was happy. I mean, they led to Sarah hating Hagar, but at least, Sarah beat Hagar, but at least Rachel didn't beat Bilhah. She was happy, so it must be okay, yeah? No. Jacob is repeating past sins. And what happens when we suggest sin? It drags people down. Rachel suggests sin and drags Jacob down. And who gets dragged down next? Leah, who thinks, this is a good idea. Why don't I do the same thing? So Leah's got four children. She stopped bearing. Rachel can't bear children at this stage. But her maid, Bilhah, does have children. And you can hear Rachel, there's nothing about Yahweh, this is God. God has judged me, verse 6, has also heard my voice and given me a son, therefore she called his name Dan. Rachel's servant Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. Not a reference to God at all at this stage. With mighty wrestlings, Rachel said, I've wrestled with my sister and prevailed. She called his name Naphtali. This is being dragged down. Then Leah, see, she ceased bearing, took a servant Zilpah, gave her to Jacob as a wife. Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Leah said, good fortune has come. Good fortune. What's happened to the references to Yahweh? They've gone. This is manipulation. Leah's servant Zilpah bore a second son. Leah said, happy am I. Where's God? Where's Yahweh? Not mentioned. Happy am I, for women shall call me happy. So she called his name Asher. Past sins are being repeated. And it's dragging everyone down. So we've now got five people dragged down into this kind of squalid childbearing by proxy methods. We've now got four wives, two top-level wives, two second-level wives. This is bad. Polygamy is bad enough, but having two tiers of wives, this is terrible. And you imagine when we start to see how the sons of Jacob live, well, what hope do you have being brought up in this kind of household? Four mothers and a lack of trust in God, a repetition of past sins for which Jacob would bear the ultimate responsibility, firstly as the father, but secondly because he knows what has happened in the past. But Genesis 28:14, the promise to Jacob, your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and the south. God blesses despite past sins being repeated. It's the blessing of God. God can work no matter what human beings do. Like, human beings can do their worst and God's plan just keeps going forward. This is why we marvel at the grace of God. It's not an excuse for just misbehavior, because God judges for misbehavior. But whatever we do, God's plan goes forward. This is the grace of God being outworked. God blesses despite past sins being repeated. We can trust the covenant-keeping God to lead us on to his intended blessing through Christ the curse reverser, against the odds and despite the failings of individuals. So then, God blesses despite the godly girl being unloved. God blesses despite past sins being repeated. And thirdly, God blesses despite superstition and strife. You might say, could this get any worse? Like, this is already pretty bad. Moses could have put down his pen and said, look, well, I've had enough of this. And there were some other children, and we'll just kind of cover over the next bit because it's just diving. Well, no. Sin leads to sin. If we're happy with sin at one level, the devil wants to take us down the next step and the next step. And we might think, well, I wouldn't go down there. Well, maybe not straight away. But the devil will lead you gently, step by step by step, down, sliding, slipping, or backsliding. So what goes on? There's Reuben. So we've got these children being born. And some of you would say, well, how long does it take these children to be born? Well, we know that in Genesis 30:26, Rachel had born Joseph, and Jacob said to Laban, send me away. I've served my 7 years for Rachel now. Well, that suggests there's a 7 year period. You might say, how can all these children be born in that pace? Well, one woman couldn't. But the text doesn't tell us that Rachel waited for all four children to be born from Leah before she's kind of saying, get going with Bilhah. So what you've got is you've got an incredible number of very young children going in this household at the same point. And the oldest one is Reuben. So he's around, and maybe he's 4 or 5 by this stage, and he's out there in the field, and he comes up these mandrakes, these orange fruit, a bit like a berry. You can imagine young children seeing a nice orange, bright orange berry. And you know that, oh, ladies like these bright orange berries. So he comes back. Look here, mummy. Look what I found. And thinks his mummy will be happy. Ladies like this, I'll take some to mum. Well, Rachel sees these mandrakes, and people thought that they were some kind of fertility help. So Rachel says to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." But she said to her, "Is it a small matter that you've taken away my husband's? Would you take away my son's mandrakes also?" Rachel said, "Then he may lie with you tonight in exchange for your son's mandrakes." When Jacob came from the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, "You must come into me, for I have hired you with my son's mandrakes." So he lay with her that night, and God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Leah said, "God has given me my wages because I gave my servant to my husband." So she called his name Issachar. Notice one thing there. Leah's reference on Issachar is also about giving her servant to husband. It's not so much against Rachel, interestingly. But also notice what it says in Exodus 21, verse 10. Exodus 21, verse 10. God speaking to his people, and he is regulating what the people are doing. He's not endorsing it, he's regulating it. God says, "If a man takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights." And so this count is suggesting that Leah's marital rights have been disrespected, and so therefore you've got this device that he might come into her. You've got this superstition of the mandrakes. You've got this strife. And what's God doing? Blessing. Multiplying. The household is in chaos, in conflict, and delving into superstition. And we can, it doesn't surprise us, does it, that the woman who wanted to steal the household gods wants the mandrakes. God continues to bless. You'll notice there, afterwards she bore a daughter and called her name Dinah. Now, whether she's born at this period or later on, we don't know. It's just kind of Moses tidying up and saying, by the way, Dinah is Leah's daughter. Because when you have four wives, you just need to be clear who had who. And it's Leah's daughter. He's just tidying up the family tree. He's more worried. You might say, well, why have you not got this stuff about names? And well, that's because the names were important because they were tribes. So you want to know, who is your tribal leader? Where does he come from? And Dinah is not a tribal head. So she's not, I isn't going into those details, but she's important later on in Genesis. So does this say, well, just go for worldly methods and superstition? Is that what this is endorsing? No. God blesses. We can trust him to lead on to intended blessing through Christ the curse reverser, against the odds and despite the failings of individuals. Imagine you're a tribe and you're the tribe of Issachar. I mean, it's not great reading history, is it? Imagine every time in the tribe of Issachar. So, okay, let's see where our dad came, our ultimate tribal head came from. And you get this story very regularly. You grow up with this story and you're thinking, oh, it's God's blessing, despite the failings of individuals. Well, finally, we've seen, what have we seen so far? God blesses despite the godlier girl being unloved. God blesses despite past sins being repeated. God blesses despite superstition and strife. And finally, we see that God blesses despite sinful impatience. Sinful impatience. I don't know where you are on the patience level. Some people are very, very chilled and just happy to wait. Other people want everything now or preferably yesterday. Well, This is not about temperament here for Rachel. We can understand her deep burden of heart, absolutely natural for her to desire to bear children. But where do we see sinful impatience? Well, we've seen it in chapter 30, verse 1. Her rage at Jacob, give me children or I shall die. We see her sin in saying, verse 3, here is my servant Bilhah, go into her that she may give birth on my behalf. We see her sinful impatience in her bitterness towards Leah, verse 8, with mighty wrestlings, I've wrestled with my sister and have prevailed. And we've seen her sinful impatience in verse 15 with this deal with Leah to do with the mandrakes. But notice verse 22. What does it say God did? God remembered Rachel and God listened to her. What is that evidence of for the first time in this chapter? What is Rachel now doing? She's praying. She's not scheming. She's praying. God remembered Rachel and God listened to her. Again, we're seeing that God is a gracious God. Just because she'd got things wrong repeatedly didn't mean that God just washed his hands of Rachel and said, right, that's it, you can remain barren forever. Messianic line through Leah doesn't matter anymore. No, God is still determined, and we know how important Joseph's going to be. He's determined to work through Leah as well, despite her own sinful impatience. And shouldn't that encourage us? Maybe you're thinking this morning, well, I've messed up again and again and again and again. Will God just wash his hands with me, not listen to any of my prayers? Well, this should encourage us, saying that God blesses despite sinful impatience. She conceived, verse 23, and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. And she called his name Joseph, saying, may Yahweh, the covenant Lord, add to me another son. She's been lifted up now to where Leah was at the start, talking about Yahweh, the covenant name of God. She has hope, not just here, but even hope for another son. And so, strikingly, this passage climaxes with another key person within the tribes. Remember, it's as if Judah has the blessing and Joseph's going to have the birthright. He's got the double portion, hasn't he? Ephraim and Manasseh. So God's blessing is going forward. It's being set up in this chapter. And it's not just God blessing despite the failings of individuals, not even just that, but God is working in these individuals to increase their faith through his grace. So this, we look at this all together, we should be saying, we should be putting away scheming and strife because God is sovereign in his blessings. And isn't that an important thing to know in many areas today, in our personal lives and in the churches? Because how many times do you see where it's just about strategy, scheming? Maybe we can kind of work out some kind of pragmatic schemes and that will build the church. How often do we see within churches there is jealousy or bickering or worry about who has what position and what role? How many times have you seen churches divided because of personality issues or quarrels which didn't need to be? Potentially within people who really shouldn't be quarrelling, between family issues. That's what it is here, isn't it? Two sisters within the same family. Saying we don't need to, we can put scheming and strife away. God is sovereign in his blessings. After all, Israel's learning Here are 11 tribal heads born where? Outside the land. God's still going to bless. This is saying any of these tribal leaders hearing their stories is not thinking this is happy families. God's going to bless. It's as if God's saying, look at the material I used. You know, sometimes you see people making something. It might be furniture out of recycled objects. And you know, sometimes it looks like you look at it and you go, okay, well, that's interesting, but it's still it was a load of rubbish, and it is now a load of rubbish just with screws in. But other times you look at it and you say, wow, look what they've done. We've abandoned this and thrown away that, and they've put it together and they've made something new and useful and beautiful. That is what God is doing. And as he's saying, he can use even me with all my sin. It's saying no individual can stop God's purposes. If we see a failure in the churches and say, oh, that's tragedy, is God going to work? God works despite the failings of individuals. So he put all this together. And it reminds him, he says, this world is not my home, but I can trust Yahweh, the covenant-keeping Creator God, to lead me, if I'm one of his people, to his intended blessing through Christ the curse reverser, despite the odds and despite the failings of individuals. And we say, he's a great God, and I can follow him all the days of my life. Amen.